don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on March 1st, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, I'm interviewing guests. Author Adam Eichen, Rabbi Michael Pollack, and journalist Paul Bless are here to talk about gerrymandering in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, as well as efforts to stop it. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. This week, we're going to be talking about gerrymandering and related issues in a number of states. We're going to start out by talking about Pennsylvania. Returning to the show, we did an interview several months ago for the book that he co-authored, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want, is Adam Eichen. And he's also brought on Rabbi Michael Pollack to talk as well. Adam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me back, Bill.
And Rabbi Pollack, welcome as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So there's been a lot of news in recent weeks about the situation in Pennsylvania with regard to gerrymandering. And we should talk about that first, what's been actually, you know, the big sort of court developments, and then talk beyond the court developments about sort of the bigger project of salvaging democracy and saving democracy in the state of Pennsylvania. What was the court situation?
So our current gerrymandered maps are pretty gerrymandered. So the League of Women Voters filed a lawsuit against the state legislature, took them to court. And recently, the state Supreme Court ruled that our maps are unconstitutional, that they are too gerrymandered. And so through a whole bunch of back and forth and a lot of political grandstanding and back deal maneuvering and that kind of stuff, we finally arrived at the point where we have a new map. And so this new map will affect the 2018 elections. Most likely, it's still not set in stone. There are still lawsuits being filed. And then this map will most definitely affect the 2020 elections. But what this map doesn't do is change the process by which we make our maps. So when the next round of redistricting happens in 2021, we'll be right back to square one unless we change the process. And so that we're working on changing the process, taking the power out of the hands of the legislature, out of the hands of politicians, and moving it into the hands of an independent, nonpartisan citizens commission so we can really just put this problem to bed.
There was an article that you've both published on alternet.org in February 23rd, 2018, that explained kind of what you're doing, but also underlined that point that you just raised about the fact that the court ruling is not a fix at all. It was a pretty narrow ruling that affects the current maps, but doesn't necessarily solve the problem. One thing that I'll be talking about later on in the program with my next guest is going to be about how in North Carolina, the strategy there every time there's a court ruling is basically just to delay, and try to get, you know, through the next election without having fixed the situation. And then ultimately, even if they are forced to maybe for one term fix the maps, then they'll just wait until the next redistricting process begins after the census, and the whole thing will start over again, and they'll just kind of stall and take it back to court. So I think I can see why in Pennsylvania you guys feel like you understandably need a more permanent strategy there. So talk to me a little bit about that. What are some of the sort of specific objectives that you are trying to get passed in Pennsylvania? And then we can talk about how you're actually setting about doing that.
Yeah, so to solve gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, we need to, right now, the state legislature and the state Supreme Court really drive the process. And our Supreme Court is a political entity. People run according to their party, and people generally vote party line for the Supreme Court justices. And so we want to take it out of the hands of those partisan bodies which have inherent conflicts of interest and move it into the hands of an independent commission made up of 11 people, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, 3 independents. They're not allowed to use metadata, and whatever map they produce has to have a vote from each of those 3 constituencies. And so we really see that the Supreme Court ruling was really nothing more than a Band-Aid. And we need to really solve this problem all out. And the reactions to the Supreme Court ruling were pretty strange and absurd. We had a cohort in our legislature who decided to try to impeach the Supreme Court rather than abide by the ruling. Others have just followed lawsuit after lawsuit to just delay, 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 exactly what you were just saying. And so we need to just undercut this, fix the process, and solve this problem for the foreseeable future.
And the model here is really based off of what's happening in California with their independent redistricting commission that they passed in 2009, I believe, but for the 2010 cycle. And it's worked really well. But this bill is looking to actually take that model even further and kind of base it off of the California model, try and plug a couple of the leaks in that model and really trying to create an even better example of what's possible with the independent redistricting commission. So the bill has, you know, support from both Republicans and Democrats alike. Same with a couple of the other bills that we're fighting for here in Pennsylvania, too.
You mentioned the California model, and I know there's a number of other states with similar panels. And you also said something about not having metadata. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit more specifically about what that panel would look like. I know you mentioned the party breakdown on it, but what would be the composition of that panel? How would that be chosen, and what would be their sort of process and objectives in drawing districts?
The 11-person commission, to be on that commission, you are not allowed to be a politician, you are not allowed to be a lobbyist, and you are not allowed to be related to either of those groups of people. And then you are not allowed to use metadata, so you're not allowed to see who everybody, you know, who people clicked on Facebook and who people, you know, every Google search, every Amazon purchase, do you read NPR, do you read Breitbart, everything that was used in the last round of redistricting to really predict who you're going to vote for the next 10 years or so. You're not allowed to use that data on this commission. So it's pretty limited in its ability to use data. And to get on that commission, you fill out a series of essay questions, and then through a lottery selection, the Secretary of the Commonwealth chooses a few people. Then there's just a few other kind of narrowing down processes to get it from 75 down to 50, down to 25, down to 11. So it's pretty in-depth, and there's about 20 pages of details that guide this process.
One of the things that I have been wondering about, I think these independent redistricting commissions are pretty essential going forward, and we need to be adopting more of them. But the model that you've described and the model that we've seen elsewhere seems to include you know, that there's this number of seats for Democrats and this number of seats for Republicans and then some, you know, unaffiliated seats. And that has sort of been also true of a lot of other unrelated commissions at the federal level for various things. And then there's sort of always a struggle for control of the majority on those if they're not evenly balanced. But the thing you're describing is essentially evenly balanced. One of the concerns, though, I think that a lot of people might have is that that's sort of even more than already is baking in the party system very fundamentally into the fabric of things. I mean, people's party alignments could change and so on, and you could have a huge shift of party alignment in a state, and then you might still have a state that's got an independent, quote-unquote, independent redistricting commission that's still, you know, 50-50, essentially. How do you kind of balance that partisan aspect with the fact that you're trying to create something sort of nonpartisan and fair?
Absolutely. So we, in our 11-person commission, we have 3 independents, which is the minority group on that commission. And that's not ideal, to be honest with you, because we do live in a two-party duopoly where Democrats and Republicans are able to really keep control and monitor the process and use that power to keep other groups out. So it's not ideal. I am hopeful that when we have hearings on this bill in the Senate, which are scheduled for March 27th at 9 a.m., that Senator Fulmer, the chairman of the State Senate Government Committee, the Senate State Government Committee, is very concerned about this as well. And so we've talked about adding amendments to the bill to up that number of independents to 5 so that they become the majority group within the commission. And there are some other ideas being kicked around to really increase independent power within this.
And I just want to add, you know, one of the reasons why I love March on Harrisburg so much and that I was willing to come down here for a whole month to help them out on their on our barnstorming tour, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about, is that, you know, the two bills that we're fighting for, this, you know, independent redistricting commission bill and a gift ban bill, because Pennsylvania is one of 10 states without any limits on the gifts that you can give to state politicians, which is ridiculous. You know, those are the two bills that March on Harrisburg is focused on right now for reasons that we can go into. But the agenda here is it's a 10-year struggle that we have a list of 20 different reform bills that Pennsylvania needs to bring its democracy from 45th worst in the country to in the top 10. And one of those is ranked choice voting, which is going to be a very big deal moving forward to break that duopoly of the parties in America.
Now, before we talk about the March on Harrisburg, which I definitely want to get into in just a moment, the thing that keeps on sort of I keep circling back to with regard to the partisan aspect is, you know, I've been seeing in a lot of the like the court cases and news articles about various states working on this issue that they'll say, you know, this is the percentage of Democratic votes that were cast in the last election statewide, but this is the percentage of seats that Republicans hold in whether it's Congress or the legislature or whatever. Is that something that the redistricting commission will be taking into account, the sort of whether it's the votes or just the registrations in terms of the breakdowns, or is the goal going to be much more simply like that you should have compact contiguous districts and that sort of thing? I mean, because that is something that is still concerning to me, not to keep harping on it, but just the idea that like you would be drawing districts based on party presences seems to be just getting, it's like a different version of the same problem as before.
Yeah, the charge of the commission is compact and contiguous and not breaking up communities of interest. So trying to maintain municipality lines, so trying to follow county lines as best as possible, trying not to break up municipalities as best as possible. It would be really impossible to try to create competitive districts across the state of Pennsylvania. They would probably look more funky than our old maps looked. Because there's, you know, downtown Philadelphia is going to be a blue district. Lebanon County is going to be a red district. And you can't make those districts competitive because they're, you know, very to one side of the spectrum, surrounded by like-minded people. Okay. So really, the charge is compact, contiguous, and not breaking up communities of interest.
All right, that makes sense. So talk to me now a little bit about March on Harrisburg and your sort of statewide strategy. I noticed in the article that you talked about that it's not just pushing for these two specific bills, but trying to set up sort of these, you call them democracy hubs across the state where people are empowered in, over the longer term to continue working on these issues, not just to try to get something passed in this particular session.
Right. And I think I'll speak to this a little bit because it ties into why I'm here in Pennsylvania for the month, because obviously I live in the Boston area. I'm not a Pennsylvania resident, but I'm down here to help. And, you know, the goal of what we're doing, we've done, Michael can talk a little bit about how he founded March on Harrisburg and what they've been doing over the past year. But what we're doing right now is we're going across the entire state holding events because, you know, the last time you and I spoke, Bill, was about my newly released book, Daring Democracy. And that book was selected as the Unitarian Universalist Association's Common Read of the Year. And so Michael and I decided to see if the UUs would be interested in putting together a tour to host us across the state. And then when we spoke, we would basically form democracy hubs that everyone in attendance, we would hope, would then kind of, in, you know, organically fight for democracy, basically trying to form really foster a democracy movement in Pennsylvania. I mean, there is one, but really, we really want to go into communities that, you know, don't always have people speaking about democracy and educate them about the two bills that we're fighting for, and then really give them the tools to organize themselves.
I noticed there was also a mention of a constitutional amendment process, and that this, by definition, has to be a longer haul process than just rallying people to, you know, call in support of a bill right now.
One thing we're really conscious about is building this as a long-term movement, because this cannot be a flash in the pan moment. This cannot be a call in because you're angry about something kind of a campaign. This needs to be sustainable and hopeful over the long term. To get this independent redistricting commission, we do need a constitutional amendment. And in Pennsylvania, that requires passing it in two consecutive legislative sessions, meaning we have to get it through in the 2017-2018 session, and then again in the 2019-2020 session, and then it goes to the ballot, and then it becomes law. And if we don't get this through by June 30th of this year, then we're going to miss out on the 2021 redistricting process. So we really have a tight deadline here. If we don't move this by June 30th, it doesn't happen until 2032.
And that's why it's so important that we have people, we have communities across the entire state fighting for these bills, and communities that we're fighting for the other bills that we'll be raising awareness for moving forward, whether it's the gift ban, ranked choice voting, public financing of elections, automatic voter registration. I mean, we have a list. The reason we chose gerrymandering reform and the gift ban is because we weighed it as, you know, what are the kind of lowest hanging fruits that have the most potential for change. I mean, those are the two standards that essentially we weighed this on. And gerrymandering, you know, because it's the end of the cycle, and we really have a deadline of this summer, and then the gift ban because we think it's the most practical, or the one that it's a Republican bill that has majority support in both houses, we think, that really could pass. We can talk about why it's not being passed, but that, you know, these are two bills that we see as practical that would make a very big difference. But it's by no means all the reform Pennsylvania needs.
Yeah, I liked the phrasing in the article there about channeling the corrosive anger felt across the Commonwealth towards constructive, immediate, and longstanding solutions.
Right.
That seems like a better way of doing things than some of the other models that we've seen.
Yeah.
Talk about that, the gift ban thing. I think most people will be pretty shocked to hear about the cash gifts part.
So in Pennsylvania, it is completely legal to give anything to any state legislator. That means brand new cars, Super Bowl tickets, endless wining and dining. Everybody in the state capitol knows 20 lobbyists who can get you tickets to the Penn State game, who can send your family to Hershey Park, who can send you your family to Bermuda or to the beaches of Italy or to the beaches of New Zealand. And everything I've just said is something that's happened in the last year. Gifts are pervasive in Harrisburg, and it's nothing short of bribery. You know, we had one rep who took an $11,000 personal check, and he used that money to buy his daughter a new car. And who knows what he gave up in return for that. When you have a culture of unlimited gifts, it's a culture of corruption. And it's written in Deuteronomy, do not accept a bribe, because a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and distorts the words of the righteous. And when you have a culture of bribery, the wise don't see and the righteous aren't heard. And that's our current situation in Harrisburg.
On the subject of Deuteronomy, can you talk to me a little bit more about the religious angle on this? Obviously, you know, you're a rabbi within one of the Jewish faith traditions, and you've also mentioned the UU role with regard to the book and the democracy efforts. Talk a little bit about the religious angle for your coalition.
I mean, first, an element of faith is required when trying to accomplish the impossible, and to uncorrupt Harrisburg certainly seems like an impossible task. So there's an element of faith that is required, and it can be a humanistic faith, a theistic faith, an atheistic faith, any type of faith. Faith in the sense of what Dr. King said, that faith is when you take the first step when you can't see the rest of the staircase. And so we really do rely on people of faith, because frankly, you need faith to believe that the impossible can happen. And secondly, you know, I see religion really as how we all get along together, and as trying to create rules and ways of life for us to live together in peace and live together in such a way where meaning and holiness can emerge. And in order to live together, we need to communicate with each other. That's kind of a foundational aspect of civilization. And what corruption does is it severs those lines of communication. if you can't afford to take a lot to take a legislator to the Penn State game, then you can't communicate. And when you can't communicate, the whole concept of representative democracy falls apart. People aren't seeing each other. The head of state becomes separated from the body of the nation, and we flail around in chaos. And that's what we're living through.
We are recording this on March 1st. So the tour process that was described in the article is that underway, still ongoing? Tell me a little bit about that tour across the state and what kind of reaction and reception you've been getting.
So we've done about 13 events so far. I think we have about 7 more to go. I think actually you're catching us in a day off right before we have 7 events in 9 days. We're doing a big West Coast swing, or West Side of the state, rather, not West Coast. So we're going to Pittsburgh in that area. And we've been across the state. It's been pretty remarkable. I mean, I always joke that, you know, this all began almost as a joke, that Michael and I were saying, you know, what if we went across the entire state of Pennsylvania and talked about these bills? That would be wild. And then all of a sudden, here we are doing exactly that. And it's really been incredible, because what I mean, 2 observations. One, people are desperately seeking ways to affect the structural issues in the United States. They desperately want to affect meaningfully our politics and to get a voice again in our political system. People are craving it. And so when we speak, it's amazing just how they you know, look and hear, listen to us with such rapt attention, because they intuitively know our democracy is broken, but they're not often able to put the words to it, the information. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give people the information and you know, the ability to voice their displeasure, to give a name to this struggle. You know, we talk a lot about the anti-democracy movement, and we give people hope by saying there is an emerging democracy movement across the country and that they are part of something larger than themselves. And that's been extremely powerful, that when we express to them that there is this movement for democracy and that they are a part of it, because they no longer feel quite as alone. But I also want to say that we've also had some conservatives come to our events. And in fact, we did an event in New York where there was a woman wearing a Scott Wagner for governor shirt. And for your listeners who don't know who Scott Wagner is, he's running against the incumbent Democrat, Tom Wolf. And Scott Wagner is a very, very conservative Republican. And this woman was wearing a Scott Wagner shirt, and I admit to you that I was a little worried that maybe some of the things, you know, I always say that democracy is the great unifying force, that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. But I was worried still, like, will this idea that Americans are more unified on democracy than we're led to believe, will that actually play out in practice? And I was shocked to find that absolutely it does, that she was nodding and clapping along, and she was 100% with us. And politically, we may not agree, but on the core question of democracy, I don't think she could have been more aligned with us. And we see this again and again and again. So in some respects, I think we're getting a real pulse on Pennsylvania politics, because everyone thinks Harrisburg is corrupt. And so we're giving people a positive, meaningful chance to reform it.
And I want to add that we're giving we're presenting a path forward and really a practical means of change. You know, I had a really moving experience a few months ago after we did an event in Lancaster, and somebody, a person about my age, about 27 years old, came up to me after the event and said, you know, me and my friends, we sit around and we're totally hopeless. And we know that the world we're growing into is not the world our parents grew into, and there's not much hope, and the future looks pretty bleak, and we're all drowning in debt. Our jobs aren't paying enough for us to really make ends meet. And he said, we all sit around in my basement and we all have guns. Pennsylvania is a really, you know, there's a lot of gun owners in this state. And he said, we sit around with our guns and we talk. And you know, we talk sometimes about doing something stupid. And he goes, seeing what you're doing is really showing that there's another way, that there's a better way forward. And that's pretty meaningful.
Well, that's, I think, a good point that I wanted to bring up. Before we close this out, is this issue of, you know, how do you give people who, there's clearly a demand, even though some people feel just completely turned off of things and are tuning out, there still clearly are a lot of people, as you've been seeing at these events, it sounds like, who aren't sure quite what to do, but they really want to do something else. And you're giving them sort of something to work on that's both short-term objectives and sort of a long-term project. But also, one of the things that I think a lot of folks like me have noticed in the last several years is a really troubling trend of a bunch of people who I would characterize them as politically very aware, but not necessarily involved. They aren't necessarily going out and doing a lot of volunteer stuff, who just seem to sort of sit around telling everyone like that they have to remember to vote in November. And that seems to be the only thing they're telling all these people who are clearly hungry for doing something in the meantime. They just say, you know, oh, you got to remember to vote. It's so important to vote. You know, how do you sort of respond to that? And do you feel like that this is, I guess, a better strategy or finding more traction than that, which seems kind of empty?
Well, I think that that's really what drew me to March on Harrisburg. Again, I live in Boston. You know, I came down here to support them. But I came down here in May of last year during their first action. They did a march from, which is why they're called March on Harrisburg, a march from Philadelphia to Harrisburg. It was over 10 days. And this, you know, preceding this was a lobbying campaign in which they met with about 240 out of the 253 legislators in Harrisburg. And then after the march was 3 days of civil disobedience. It was a very encompassing strategy, and everyone had a role to play. And I think that's really meaningful that there are many ways to participate in politics beyond just saying, you know, vote in November. And March on Harrisburg gives people opportunities where they meet. March on Harrisburg meets people where they are in that struggle. And I think that's really meaningful that people can participate. We had someone who couldn't really participate, but what she did, she cooked for us. She sustained us during the march, and she felt an incredible part of this effort. And I think that's incredible. And in all of these aspects of the strategy, from marching to lobbying to civil disobedience to outreach, you know, it leads me back to something that you and I talked about the last time I was on the show, which has been sitting with me for a long time, actually. And you said that one of the key parts we're talking about in the book, we talk about the thrill of democracy and all these kind of emotional changes that come upon us when we fight for something bigger than ourselves. And you said something about how one of the best parts about, you know, or the best ways to have people stay in politics, not get burned out, is to treat politics, yes, as something we do, but also a means of developing friendships. That it becomes much easier when we have points in time where we hang out after the action, after the lobbying campaign. And that's what March on Harrisburg really facilitates. It's, yes, it's political, but it's also community and friendship building. And for me, that's what they need to have this long fight for democracy. That's what's going to sustain them moving forward. And that's what drew me to Pennsylvania. Because in the course of that march, I developed such strong friendships with these wonderful democracy advocates in Pennsylvania that when Michael said, you want to come down here for a month and go across the state, I was like, of course, because it means that I get to spend a month with you guys. And I think that's the key here, that yeah, this struggle is really tough, but March on Harrisburg, they understand that this isn't, that politics isn't the end. It is the end, but it's in the process of getting to the end that we develop friendships and connections that lead us to the promised land.
As I said earlier, we're recording this on March 1st. This is going to air on March 6th. What do we want folks to take away from this and be aware of? Any key dates coming up? I think you mentioned something happening on the 27th, but anything that you want folks to be aware of, anything that folks, whether they're in or not in Pennsylvania, can do to get involved in this?
If you're in Pennsylvania and if you're on the western half of the state, we'll be in Slippery Rock on March 8th. We'll be in Pittsburgh on March 9th and again on March 10th. We'll be in Indiana on March 11th, we'll be in Altoona on March 12th, and we'll be in Wyoming Valley on March 13th. And you can find our whole schedule at the website, marchonharrisburg.org. Also, please donate. We are about as bare bones of an organization as possible. I'm sure you could imagine that we don't have any billionaire funders, we don't have any millionaire funders, and foundations tend to be involved in the political process, and we tend to get bad-mouthed. By people who were trying to make less corrupt, so we do need funding. We just entered into a partnership with Represent Us, a national get money out of politics group, and they are matching recurring donations 4-1. So if you can give $5 a month, that becomes $25 a month. $10 a month becomes $50 a month. It really adds up quickly. So please do that. And then finally, on our website, marchonharrisburg.org. We have an action toolkit. So if you're anywhere in the state of Pennsylvania, please take action. And if you're not in the state of Pennsylvania and you still feel like calling Representative Daryl Metcalf, I highly encourage you to do so.
And very quickly, I'll just say that, you know, the goal here, Bill, is to export this model, that we have a model of lobbying, marching, civil disobedience, cultivating around concrete pieces of legislation that we're hoping to export to states without ballot initiatives. Pennsylvania is one of the many states without a ballot initiative. So this whole model was determined or was created to react to what do you do when you have a legislature that does not want to pass democracy reforms and you can't bypass them. So our hope is to export this to Wisconsin and other states across the nation that very desperately need a democracy movement. And there are democracy movements in those places. We really want to unify them, give them a strategy, and lift up their voices.
All right. Adam Eichen, as I said, is the co-author of Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. And Rabbi Michael Pollack is the founder of March on Harrisburg at marchonharrisburg.org. Adam and Rabbi Pollack, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about this today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
All right. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Please stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. So far this hour, we've been talking about the Pennsylvania efforts regarding reform of the gerrymandering system, trying to prevent gerrymandering of various legislative and congressional districts, as well as the effort to end the giving of gifts to large gifts to state legislators. But as I said earlier in the show, we're going to be talking now about North Carolina. And for that, we've brought back on Delaware's own North Carolina expert, Paul Bless, the newly minted night editor at Splinter News. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, there's a lot of stuff that's been happening in North Carolina since we last talked. This has been your bread and butter for a number of years now. There's a lot of legislative gerrymandering, congressional gerrymandering, and even some stuff involving the courts. I guess where do we start on this? Because there's so much we can talk about.
Yeah, so I guess the place to start would be the legislative gerrymandering stuff. So over the last 6 years that the Republicans have been in control of the state legislature, they have sort of rigged the system in a number of ways, you know, notably with the congressional redistricting process and the state legislative redistricting process. And they've been taken to court several times over the past, you know, 6 years about this. They were forced to redraw the congressional maps in 2016, and they did that. And then earlier this year, a federal court said that the redrawn maps were not good enough and they had to redraw them again. And the Supreme Court granted them a stay. So the congressional maps should be the same for 2018 as they were in 2016, you know, barring any major Supreme Court decision on gerrymandering nationally. But yesterday, the filing period closed for the state legislative districts the filing period closed for the congressional races, the state legislative races, and Democrats have 170 there's 170 state legislative seats, and Democrats have a candidate, at least one candidate in every one of those races, which is a pretty marked departure from recent years. And the state legislative seats were you know, after a number of court battles, they ordered a good portion of the seats to be redrawn by this guy who's a Stanford law professor named Nathan Persily. So he redrew some of the you know, the districts, and then the Supreme Court granted a stay on some of the districts. So it's a very convoluted, confusing process, you know, largely because the Supreme Court is conservative now with Gorsuch on the court. But yeah, you know, things are sort of moving along here. There's court battles going on every day over a number of things with regards to congressional and legislative stuff. But I think we're sort of in a holding period right now until the Supreme Court decides, you know, what the fate of gerrymandering is.
It seems like a lot of the strategy by Republicans in North Carolina has been to run out the clock on everything, like, and just try to. If they're ordered to do something, they just try not to do it for as long as possible and hope that they can get away with it. Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
I think it's definitely a fair assessment of the situation, because in 2020 there's another census, so we have to go through these processes again. The one thing that's notable about North Carolina now is because we have a Democratic governor, he's powerless because there's two veto-proof supermajorities in the state Senate and the state House, with these illegally drawn seats. So I think that their goal is to try to keep those veto-proof majorities in place and just make it to 2020, with their majorities intact, so they can do the same thing for the 2022 elections. And then we go through this for another, decade, basically.
I know that there's been a lot of other sort of mobilizing of activism around various other issues in North Carolina. And certainly we've talked previously on the show about all the preemption issues where the state Republicans try to ban sort of local efforts. The guests earlier on the program talking about Pennsylvania were talking about their strategy for organizing sort of short-term and long-term networks across the state to work on these issues, establish an independent redistricting process, that sort of thing, because there's no referendum system. They have to work through the legislature. In North Carolina, has there been any effort in terms of sort of a wider push to, not just get a one-off redistricting improvement, but to try to put something in place that will hopefully solve this problem permanently? I don't know if that's been like part of the Moral Mondays or anything like that.
Yeah, so it hasn't been a particular focus of the Moral Mondays, but Democrats have been calling for this for years. And the problem is that, when the Democrats controlled the legislature and most of the governorships from the 1890s up until 2011. So they had a lot of time to implement an independent redistricting process. And once the Republicans took power, the Democrats, became more of a we need independent redistricting party. And the Republicans were like, well, you had your chance to do that. We're not going to do that. In talking to, legislators in the Democratic Party, their goal, if they break this supermajority and if they're, able to even, get a majority, which I don't think is going to happen. I don't think it's a Virginia situation at all. But, their goal is to implement an independent redistricting process because North Carolina is a purple state. It's one of the most purple states along with Pennsylvania. The fact that we have two supermajorities in a state that had a number of close races in 2016, including the governor's race, the presidential race, the fact that we have supermajorities at all just doesn't really make sense at all. So I think it is a goal of the Democrats to change things because, this is not a strong Democratic state anymore. So I think that the Democrats recognize that there's no way that they're going to be able to gerrymander, supermajorities in their favor. So, I think that they do want to go towards an independent redistricting process whenever they're in the majority next, whenever that is.
One thing that I was interested in was you alluded briefly to comparing to the situation in Virginia, which had off-year elections last year,
right.
And that there were a lot of it ended up being very close. I think they literally decided control of one chamber by a coin toss in one race, which seems like probably a broken way of handling democracy. But that is a tangent. In North Carolina. I was just pulling up some statistics from UNC to see like how big of districts we're talking about here, because like there's a lot of variance between states in how big these districts are. So a typical, so to speak, district in for the state Senate in North Carolina might be about just shy of 199,000 people, which is, I would say, pretty large compared to some legislatures I'm familiar with. And then in the House, it would be like 83,000 or so for the House districts. And, I don't know if that's changed since the 2014 or whenever this UNC thing, but that should give us a rough benchmark for what we're talking about in terms of size of districts. You said that the Democrats have now recruited people from all over the state of North Carolina to run in every single race in the is it in both chambers or one chamber or,
every single race in both chambers. So there's 50 state Senate seats and 120 state House seats. I mean, I should also note that the Republicans recruited everybody in 169 of the 170 districts. And the NCGOP executive director, who was an absolute clown. Said that a unaffiliated candidate's probably going to run in the last district that Republicans don't have a candidate in. So yeah, this is going to be we're going to see competitive election a lot more districts than we saw in 2014 and 2016.
So I pulled up the statistics for Virginia. This is a few years older at this point. This was like after the 2010 census, but actually very comparable sized districts. So 200,000 for a Senate district and 80,000 people for a House district. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because although you said, you know, that there's, you know, we're probably not looking at a Virginia situation in terms of potentially flipping chamber control. One of the things that I think a lot of people have and maybe even party establishment people had kind of locked them or talked themselves into and then locked themselves into was this mentality that like, oh, because of the gerrymandering, it's all hopeless. We can't possibly win. But, you know, in Virginia, we saw, for example, the one of the House Republican leaders losing an election in what was supposed to be a safe district for the Republicans because the Democrats ran a great campaign with a great candidate in that district, Lee Carter. Do you see, even if there's not necessarily a prospect of flipping control of the chambers in North Carolina, are we looking at potentially, you know, knocking out those supermajorities? Are there races that we might see surprise upset wins for despite the gerrymandering because we're actually contesting these races finally?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. And I think that another reason is that people have seen, you know, a couple of years of Donald Trump at that point, and they've seen 6 or 7 years of Republican control over the legislature. So I do think that there's, and obviously, you know, we had HB 2 a couple of years ago, which is a huge national issue. You know, so, you know, the legislature has sort of made North Carolina into a laughingstock. And I think that it's possible, you know, we could see, you know, significant gains, but I, you know, they only need four wins in the state Senate and the state House to break the super majorities in those chambers. So I do think that they're going to break the super majorities, but, you know, in North Carolina, they were much more surgical with their targeting and their, you know, gerrymandering than they were in Virginia. At least what I've read about the Virginia districts, I'm not as familiar with them. So I don't think that there's going to be, you know, a flip in control of the houses, but, you know, they could definitely, you know, knock down the majorities to, you know, a 65-55, you know, state house, you know, majority for the Republicans. And, you know, given that they have a Democratic governor, that means he can start vetoing things again. So, you know, some of the worst ideas by, you know, Republicans aren't going to get through as easily as they did in the past. I, you know, that's just my prediction.
I guess optimistically, because the districts have relatively large populations, but and some of them are certainly very spread out geographically. In North Carolina, it's a big state.
Right.
But I guess, like, I know I've looked at some turnout sometimes for North Carolina. It's not that great in many places. I guess that even in a place that has like a 20 or 30 point lean, supposedly, you know, or maybe during a presidential election, it does. I guess there's a possibility that for a midterm year, if you have a good Democrat and a good campaign, you know, maybe the turnout will be relatively low, but you'll be able to get more of the democratically minded voters out to vote that year. I guess that's a possibility that could help with some upsets. I think it's good though that they're actually contesting it as opposed to just like saying, well, it's hopeless because of the gerrymandering.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, it's always good to have competitive races, and I think that Virginia showed that some of these, you know, upsets like the Lee Carter race and the Danica Rome race. I think it shows that if you have a strong candidate who, you know, can campaign and you know, really target the district in a way that, you know, the Democrats haven't in a long time, I think you can see some of those upsets like you saw in Virginia. You know, I don't think it's going to happen everywhere, but, you know, all it takes is a really strong candidate who can connect with voters, and, you know, a, you know, low turnout year. I mean, this is sort of what we've seen, over the last couple of years when it comes to these special elections. You know, Democrats are, you know, putting forward these candidates and, you know, it's a very low turnout special election and, you know, they campaign well, the Republican doesn't campaign at all. And then they flip these, you know, ruby red seats. I mean, there's going to be more people voting in a midterm election than a special election, but I think the same idea applies.
I saw an article that as of the last Tuesday in February, the Democrats had won nearly 40 special elections across the country since the 2016 election or since Donald Trump's inauguration.
I haven't seen many special elections in North Carolina. I'm not sure if there have been any. I'm pretty sure that the parties pick replacements. But yeah, in neighboring states, you know, even more conservative states like Georgia, this is happening in. So I think it definitely a possibility for the midterms.
All right. So what else has been going on? We've talked about some of the stall tactics from the legislature on avoiding doing the elections over again or using a new map or whatever. What else do we need to know about where things stand currently? I think you mentioned there's a judicial aspect as well. Do you have elected judges in North Carolina?
We have elected judges in Carolina, and they made it they made these races nonpartisan, several years ago, and now the legislature is trying to make them partisan races again. So the judicial stuff in North Carolina, I think, ties in with some of the stuff that's happening in Pennsylvania. I mean, after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ordered the congressional districts to be redrawn, a number of legislators there said, you know, we should think about impeaching these judges that ruled in this way. And I think that sort of the same thing is happening in North Carolina. There hasn't been, you know, much of a call for impeachment, but the North Carolina Supreme Court is now, you know, a majority represented by Democrats. It's a 4-3 split, I think. Over the last couple of sessions, you know, the legislature has you know, tried to make the process more partisan. They had redistricting plans that they've been looking at for, you know, a number of months now that were, you know, they were really pushing last session. They weren't able to get it through in the short time period. But, you know, this year they're looking at, you know, merit-based selection of judges. And I use, you know, merit in heavy air quotes because it's really just the legislature picking, you know, a pool of judges for people to, you know, pick their judges from. And they're also looking at a constitutional amendment to stop electing judges, which, you know, may sound like a good idea at this point. I think, you know, theoretically, it's probably a good idea. But the legislature is just going to stack the courts everywhere in North Carolina with Republican judges.
That is sort of the flip side of the argument about all the problems that are associated with having elected judges. And there are many problems that if you put it to the control of the legislature, then they can end up just stacking yet another branch.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's sort of the, you know, I've talked to lawyers who've been working on this issue. I've talked to legislators and, you know, sort of the feeling is that the legislature, even by, you know, talking about doing this or attempting to do it or talking to reporters about doing it, you know, they're putting it in the current judges' minds that they have to follow this party line if they want to keep their jobs, if they don't want to get double bunked in their, you know, next judicial redrawing of the maps. And the maps hadn't been redrawn in, you know, 30 or 40 years. And now they're, you know, trying to redraw the district attorney maps and the Superior Court judge maps. They've done a number of things with the judiciary in North Carolina to sort of cement control, because I think that they are going to lose the supermajority in 2018, and they want to get as much stuff done as they humanly can before that happens.
So wait, the judicial districts haven't been redrawn in 40 years, despite all the population changes?
Yeah, so that's it. I think the last time that they did it, it might actually be a little bit longer. I got to look up the exact year, but I think it was the 60s or 70s when they last redrew the judicial district. So you can make an argument that this is sort of long overdue, but the way that they were doing it, you know, they weren't soliciting input from, you know, the people who hold these statistics, like the nonpartisan agency that actually, you know, looks at caseloads and stuff like that. And, you know, a number of the Republican Supreme Court and appeals court judges spoke out against the plan. So they weren't able to, you know, implement that, this broad plan that they were looking at. And I can send you something I wrote about that for Scallywag last year.
We'll put it up on the Arsenal for Democracy website so people can read the more info on that if they want.
Sure. Yeah. So I think at its core, they're really trying to consolidate some control over every branch. I mean, this is something that we've seen over the last couple of years since Cooper was elected. You know, it's not even just the state government. We see it in local governments. I mean, it wasn't just the legislature's districts that they gerrymandered or the congressional districts that they gerrymandered. They tried to gerrymander the Wake County School Board, where Raleigh is, and the Wake County Board of Commissioners. They tried to gerrymander the Greensboro City Council, which is one of the most liberal city councils in the state. I mean, you know, this is sort of an all-out effort in all, you know, facets of political life in North Carolina for Republicans to sort of cement their power for generations.
The reason that I was asking earlier about the judge redistricting is just because I know that there have been cases decided in the past by the Supreme Court about the issue of what are essentially rotten boroughs. That's a term from UK politics, but had been a problem, I think. I don't remember how recently in the United States. I know it was a huge problem in the 19th century, as it was in England. But basically, the rotten borough problem is where you wait to redistrict so long that there you end up with a district that has like maybe 10 voters in it or something like that because everyone has moved out of it. That was one of the issues in England historically, was that all these people were leaving the countryside and moving into these districts in, you know, London or wherever, or some area of the city, of some city would get depopulated for some reason, but yet they would still have the equal size district. And so it's kind of startling to hear that they hadn't done the redistricting like that in North Carolina. And of course, now they've suddenly remembered that they can do it now that they want to stack the courts again.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's part of the argument that the Republicans are making. You know, this is a long overdue process. And we need to, you know, redistrict. And some of the combinations that they made, had voters with, you know, in a district that, or a county that, you know, had seen a lot of population decrease. But they would pair these, you know, overly liberal small counties with like the conservative county that's like, you know, next to it, but doesn't really make sense in terms of the population. So I think that, you know, I think you're exactly right. I mean, this is something that probably is long overdue. You know, the district attorneys are probably, you know, a little bit too comfortable. They've probably been incumbents we've seen a number of, you know, longtime incumbents, even in the bigger cities in North Carolina, like Raleigh. But yeah, I think that, you know, this is something that is long overdue, but the way that they're going about it is just sort of the typical, you know, we just need to cement power.
I guess, yeah, it's hard not to be discouraged by some of this stuff because they've just, I mean, you got to give them credit. A lot of these Republicans, I would say, are not very bright, but the people who are running them essentially are very adept at picking, sort of analyzing the structures of the system and figuring out where they can attack with full force to gain, you know, total control. And they've done that very effectively. And I think the Democrats are still largely not being that strategic, although, of course, now I think it is encouraging that they've recruited all these candidates all over the state for the legislature, at least. But, you know, that's not really a permanent structural fix itself.
No, it isn't. And I think that you sort of nailed it. I mean, this kind of trope of the country bumpkin Republican in North Carolina just doesn't really apply. I mean, these people are incredibly smart and just trying to, you know, at least the, you know, the Phil Burgers, who's the state Senate president, you know, these are people who know how to, you know, wield power and are not afraid to do it. And, you know, that's something that I think that, that, you know, Democrats in states like Massachusetts and Delaware would probably do well to learn a little bit from, you know, even if, you know, what Burger's doing is, you know, incredibly oppressive in a number of ways. You know, I think that the way that the North Carolina Republicans have wielded power over the last several years shows that we're not in this, you know, this place where we have a bipartisan consensus. I mean, the bipartisan consensus just doesn't exist anymore. And the only way that they're ever going to go for a bipartisan consensus is they have to. And, you know, that's something that I think North Carolina and states like Pennsylvania are proving.
What do you think people should know regarding North Carolina, you know, in the next few months or the next couple of years? Like, what's the thing to keep an eye on?
I think that, you know, North Carolina's demographics are changing pretty rapidly. You know, people are pouring into Wake County, where I live, every day. You know, I'm originally from Delaware. I grew up in Wilmington and moved down here a couple years ago. And, you know, people are coming here every day. People are coming to places like the Triangle and Charlotte. And I think that, you know, as more people pour in here, as, you know, a more liberal, you know, young demographic gets older, I think that, you know, the potential is there definitely for, you know, North Carolina to become even more of a swing state, to become a Democratic state. But, you know, there's still going to be this push and pull with the Republicans. You know, in 2020, we're probably going to see a tough, you know, North Carolina is obviously going to be in play in the presidential election. The gubernatorial race is probably going to be between Roy Cooper and either a rematch with Pat McCrory or you know, him facing off against the current Lieutenant Governor, Dan Forrest, who's an HB2 maniac. So I think that, you know, it's still going to be super competitive in North Carolina in the next couple of years. And, you know, my gut feeling is we're still going to see the same amount of insane news coming out of the state with regards to gerrymandering, with regards to, you know, LGBTQ rights in the next couple of years, as we have seen in the last couple of years.
All right. Well, Paul Blessed, thank you so much for coming back on Arsenal for Democracy to update us on the situation in North Carolina. And congratulations as well on your new role at Splinter.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure to come back.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.